I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It doesn't seem like all that long ago that we were doing show after show after show talking about how we should fix the broken American healthcare system. And here we are today talking about an American healthcare system that doesn't seem to be entirely fixed yet. Our guest this hour has written, "Cost and quality issues have long plagued the U.S. healthcare system. We have these problems because insurance companies are at the center of the system where they both finance and manage care. If this system is so flawed, how did we get stuck with it in the first place?" Christy Ford Chapin is our guest. She's a visiting scholar at Johns Hopkins University, assistant professor of history at the University of Maryland, author of Insuring America's Health, the Public Creation of the Corporate Healthcare System. We'll be welcoming phone calls. We haven't talked about healthcare in a long time, and so I would imagine we're going to have more than a few phone calls because the costs are going up. The Affordable Health Care, Affordable Care Act costs are going up. Everybody's costs are going up. We'll try to figure out why that continues to be the case. And we can learn perhaps from our history on this issue and others. So it's fascinating to learn what happened in this country in the 1900s, in the 30s, and in the 40s. Here's our phone number. Keep it in mind as we talk during the course of the hour. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Christy, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Kathleen. I appreciate it.
Well, I look forward to this history lesson because it really is fascinating. Let's start with where we are now. Our health care costs, everybody's complaining about it all the time because the costs keep going up, and we thought we had solved the problem. We haven't done anything close to that, have we?
No, not at all. And in fact, one point I try to make in the book is, you know, a lot of these cost increases are being associated with the recent reforms passed under the Obama administration, the Affordable Care Act or the ACA. But the point I'm trying to make is these costs have been a problem for a long time. And the ACA, yes, it's somewhat exacerbating it, but it's built on a very costly model that already existed.
Yeah. Well, tell us about this model that I think very few people know about. Between the 1900s, you write, and the 1940s, patients flocked to what were called prepaid physician groups. This is an intriguing idea worth revisiting, perhaps.
Right. One thing I was kind of surprised when I went back and started doing my research, when I started researching the book, I was interested in the insurance company's role in the healthcare system. But I think one thing that surprised me, it's been written about somewhat, but just was how much was going on in the healthcare marketplace between, like you said, the beginning of the 20th century and the 1940s. There were all kinds of models out there. There were plans run by unions, plans run by consumer cooperatives, African-American fraternal orders, ethnic mutual aid societies, business groups, a lot of different models. But the one I focus on in the article you're referencing in the conversation was this particularly elegant model called the physician, the prepaid physician group. And that model is very interesting because I argue that it offered higher quality care and also that they kept the cost down. The physicians did in this model.
Mm-hmm. And essentially, and it was also kind of a one-stop shopping place, right? So that it wasn't just your GP. At the end of the day, GPs and specialists for thornier cases would be talking to each other.
Exactly. So if you think about it, it kind of makes sense that this is what physicians wanted to do. What physicians did is they would get together in a group, and I know a lot of your listeners are probably thinking, okay, big deal, we have physician groups today. But if you think about it, they're always single specialty. It's always a group of general practitioners or a group of neurologists mm-hmm. or a group of orthopedists. What physicians were doing previously is they were getting together, blending all their specialties. Everybody was coming from their background. And that was really important for the quality of care. First of all, physicians really liked learning from people in other specialties, so there was this constant learning going on. And second of all, this is particularly important for people who are not healthy, for people who are chronically ill, the elderly, and also for people who are difficult to diagnose. So what I found out with these groups is at the end of the day, what they would do is they had their times they could sit down and discuss the trickiest cases to try to figure out how to manage a case. You know, I think we all know today, those of us with elderly relatives or even some of us who maybe have certain medical conditions, it can be difficult to figure out, you know, to always make sure, is this medication I have from this doctor going to interfere with this other medication I have from this doctor? No, most of us do not have one physician managing our total complete medical profile from our back problems to our asthma to our, you know, depression or whatever it may be. Right. But that's what these groups offer.
And how did you link up with one of these groups? Did you pay your doctor some kind of fee? How did it work financially?
Exactly. The way it worked financially is the reason they were able to keep costs in line. So instead of patients and families paying the insurance company or some third party, they directly paid the physician group. So you would pay the physician group in order to get all your health care benefits because the physician group would contract on the back end with a hospital, or sometimes they even built their own hospital facilities.
Mm.
So the reason this is so important is because it aligned the incentives correctly for physicians. Physicians are the gatekeepers to our medicine. And one of the problems we have today is the way that they're paid under the insurance company model is that they're often paid for every service and procedure that they offer. And it just makes sense rationally because they're paid that way that there tends to be an oversupply of care for people who have insurance. And a lot of times they're trying to do that, too, to make up for maybe other places they think that they're not getting paid what they should because of what the insurance company pays. But under the prepaid group, what happened was physicians, they earned a portion of the profits from the group. So if they oversupplied care, they were just hurting themselves financially. But on the other end, if they withheld care and they didn't give people the care they thought that they deserved, they also hurt themselves in the pocketbook because then people would not continue with their group. In fact, there were so many hundreds of these groups all around the country until, you know, we can talk about how the AMA moved,
right,
the American Medical Association moved to shut them down, but there were so many groups that a lot of them were competing against other groups for the patient's monthly fee, for their insurance fee.
Mm-hmm. And then you write, as prepaid doctor groups gained in popularity, which indeed they did, the AMA took notice and began organizing to combat them. Why? The doctors were happy with them, weren't they?
Yes, most rank-and-file physicians were pretty happy, from what I can find. Of course, there's no, you know, sometimes we can't always find the data we want. But just from the fact that I know that by the early 1930s, there were, you know, over 300, 350 by the AMA's own count, and they might have been undercounting those. They seem to have been quite popular with physicians. So the physicians I'm talking about who organized to shut them down were the leaders of the AMA. And some of them had different concerns. They tended to be the wealthier doctors who were specialists in the city. So they often had different concerns from some of the kind of rank and file physicians, maybe some of the more country doctors and general practitioners. And their concern was actually quite rational. If you think about it, at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, something was going on in civilization that was quite scary to a lot of people across different professions, and that was the rise of the large corporation.
Mm.
People were very fearful of these gigantic hierarchical bureaucracies that had so much power, you know, that seemed to have so much more power than the government. And basically, the leaders of the AMA were looking at accountants and engineers and thinking, we don't want to be like them. We don't want to get pulled into these corporations and be accountable to other people. That if we're pulled into a corporation, we'll lose autonomy. You know, we'll lose our ability to practice as we see fit. We won't be in charge of medical care, and we'll also, of course, lose earning power, professional prestige. So their fear with the prepaid doctor group was, hey, this is a nascent corporation. We see capital pooling. We see physicians working together. That can very easily turn into a larger, and there were some prepaid groups, too, that had 50, 100 physicians working for them. So you can see where this fear came from.
Yeah, so let's turn it over to insurance companies, and then, of course, we'll be able to keep our autonomy, right? Of course.
Yeah, it worked for a couple decades. decades, but obviously, yes, that completely got eroded too, whereas, you know, I now argue that insurance companies in a lot of ways have gotten a lot more power over physicians than I think physicians are comfortable with and patients are comfortable with, to the point that in order to try to control costs, insurance companies are now supervising physicians and even dictating to them how they should practice medicine, which I think is concerning
right.
for all of us.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit. I don't know much about this, and I find it fascinating. Many healthcare reformers, you say, including those behind President Truman's failed 1948 universal care proposal, hope to develop the medical economy around what we were just talking about, those prepaid groups. Progressive believe that by federally funding prepaid groups, they'd efficiently supply the entire population with comprehensive care. Do you agree that that would have been the case? And then secondly, who led the charge against Truman's proposal back in 48?
So basically, progressive reformers had been looking at the prepaid physician group as a way, they thought it was the ideal foundation for a government program all the way going back to the 1920s. There was a committee on the cost of medical care. It was a private group, but they were looking at how the healthcare economy should be set up. And a lot of them wanted to figure out how to set up the private economy, make it as efficient as possible so that once government funding was added, it too would be efficient. So by the time we get to the 1940s, these ideas have not gone away. In fact, it's a lot of the same people who are on the CCMC committee back in the late 1920s. And so their idea, you know, if you look back at the publicity and the debates around the program, it's not, you know, they're not always explaining, hey, we want to put it back on the prepaid group. I found that by digging through the archives, exactly what they were trying to do and how they were doing it. But as you can imagine, the AMA was already livid enough at what they were doing. They weren't about to bait them and say, yes, you know, we're going to put this back on the prepaid group system. But what is interesting with Truman's proposal for universal care in 1948 when he surprised a lot of pundits and won re-election, was that the AMA joined together with insurance companies at that point, in the healthcare business, and also with business groups like the Chamber of Commerce to lobby against the bill. In fact, it was probably the largest campaign ever waged against one piece of legislation
really?
In our history.
Wow.
Yeah. Millions of pieces of literature passed out, pamphlets, for example, a reprint. The Reader's Digest had done an unfavorable story of the British healthcare system.
Hmm.
So they I think they made like 5 million reprints.
Whoa.
That passed it out. Yeah, there were billboards, radio ads. Physicians had materials hanging in their office. They would even write prescriptions for patients with the name of the congressman that they wanted them to vote for, who would vote against Truman's health care plan.
Mm. And Ike wanted a universal plan as well?
Eisenhower did not. He wasn't quite. Now, some of these compromises you're referring to, even after Truman was out, and so we get President Eisenhower in office during the 1950s, and a lot of people think, oh, well, Eisenhower's a Republican, right? So surely he left everything alone and let the insurance companies and physicians do as they wanted. What's so interesting that I found was that even though Truman's plan was defeated, some of the very people who voted against Truman's plan in Congress and also who were against it, like President Eisenhower, still wanted to reform the healthcare system because they were looking at the insurance company model that the AMA had put together and saying this model is crazy.
Uh-huh.
It's so expensive. The care isn't as good. We have to present some kind of reform. So Eisenhower's wasn't universal, but it was a program to pay back insurance companies for the money that they would inevitably lose for insuring population groups like the elderly, the chronically ill, to encourage them to make their insurance policies more generous, because at first they were very, very meager benefits because the mechanism for funding health care under the insurance company model was so expensive in that physicians demanded that insurance companies, at first at least, give them complete autonomy, pay them for every single service and procedure that they delivered. And this is what began this, you know, oversupply of care. So it wasn't just Eisenhower who offered legislation to reform the healthcare program during the 1950s. There were numerous legislative proposals coming out of Congress, and there was indeed a universal plan that came out from a group of more progressive Republicans in the Senate and the House who wanted states, and this is kind of interesting from the perspective of today and our state exchanges under the ACA, wanted states to purchase insurance for everybody and resell it to people based on what their income was.
Yeah, so interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
So in the 30s, we'll get to today in a moment, I promise. Insurance companies, you say, sold life insurance policies. They worked with businesses to provide employee pensions. They had no interest in entering the health care field. So why did they go along with the AMA plan?
Yeah, that's the real funny thing today, now that they're at the center of everything.
Right.
Yeah, and managing, you know, the public sector and the private sector and healthcare. At first, it was, you know, it makes me chuckle because I'm thinking back to looking into the archives and seeing how they keep being asked by employers to cover health insurance or write health insurance policies for their employees, and they keep saying, "No way, no way, are we going to get involved in that? That's nuts." So basically, what happened is, the AMA had cleared out the market and done everything they could to destroy all these different experiments. I've mentioned the consumer cooperatives, the union-run programs, the prepaid doctor groups. They were able to really, really crush all these different healthcare experiments simply because they controlled state licensing boards.
Mm.
So physicians who failed to comply with their opposition to these groups lost their licenses, often their hospital admitting privileges and such.
Mm-hmm.
So as they cleared out the market, the problem became the federal and the government pressure increased. During the 1930s, of course, this is the Great Depression. This is the New Deal. A lot of unprecedented experiments are occurring at the federal level. And, of course, reformers are eyeing health care.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, many of them wanted to put health care funding in the original 1935 Social Security bill. But President Franklin Roosevelt said, you know, no way. I'm afraid that physician opposition could sink the entire thing. So basically, the AMA is winning on in the private sector in that they're able to crush all these alternative financing models, but they realize they need to come up with something in order to make the political argument that federal reform is unnecessary, because they wanted to point to the private sector and say, look, it's doing great, it's thriving, look how robust it is, we don't need reform. And so at the end of the 1930s, that's when you find them just constructing out of whole cloth this insurance company model, with the insurers quite, you know, terrified of getting involved.
Gosh.
But getting involved for two reasons. First of all, they too wanted to join with the AMA to oppose nationalization of health care.
Mm-hmm.
There was an idea amongst the business community that health care was particularly important. There was this idea that if the health care sector fell, so to speak, to federal control, then that would set up a precedent that would kind of a domino effect through all the rest of the economic sectors and lead to more robust federal government power throughout the entire economy.
Mm. What a story. So, what a history. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to tell you the second reason that the insurance...
Oh, sure. Let's hear it.
Off.
Yeah.
And that was because their business clients, to whom they sold life insurance and pension products for their employee groups, kept requesting health insurance. It was a way for them. They had a nice tax benefit for providing fringe benefits, and it was a way for them to try to thwart union organizing.
Hmm.
So... that was the second reason.
All right, let's go to phone calls. We'll do it momentarily. All our lines are filled. Here's the number for you to join the conversation a little bit later. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Christy Ford Chapin, visiting scholar at Johns Hopkins University, assistant professor of history at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. is our guest, and we're talking about why it is that insurance companies control your medical care. What a story, huh? We'll be with you momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls, and we start with Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen. Another wonderful program.
Thanks, Scott.
As an elderly gentleman who is on Medicare, I think that most of my peers think it's a really good program, seems to work pretty well for it. So what I'd like to know is when somebody like Bernie Sanders comes out and says, why don't we just expand Medicare, what is the rationale for arguing against that?
Christy?
Yes, Medicare does work very well, particularly for this generation, but there are a couple problems with it. One thing I show in my book is that Medicare, actually, much to the chagrin of the people who designed it, created under the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, ended up being based on the insurance company model. They didn't want to do this because they had been working for decades to try to get rid of the insurance company model. But by the time we get to 1965, the private market with the insurance company model had been developing for so long. They had all the systems in place. The insurance companies had all their connections and processes set up with the physicians. They had the organizational capacity necessary, basically, to manage health care in a way that the federal government simply could not at that time out of the Social Security offices. So they reluctantly decide to go ahead and put it on the insurance company model, incorporate everything, and indeed insurance companies administer a good deal of Medicare. They're the financial intermediaries in between the federal government and hospitals and doctors. You probably heard me say, oh, Medicare is great for this generation. I'm sure you've seen some of the statistics about the fact that if there are any budget items we're going to worry about, it's Social Security and particularly Medicare. It isn't just that we have a larger aging population than we necessarily have of younger people to pay into the system to support it. It's also, I would argue, yes, treating the elderly is expensive, but treating the elderly is many, many, many orders more expensive because we're using this specific model in the Medicare program. So it's not a problem right now,
yes.
But it will be. It will be a massive crisis soon.
So what kind of model should we be using, do you think?
I would argue for something that does take into account incentives. And that's one reason that, all in my book, I discuss many different models that existed. But, I would say, if for example, we had a President Clinton and she's able to somehow get through a public option, I think there's no doubt that I think everybody is saying that the ACA, whether some people want to roll it back, but even those who want to keep it say it needs additional reforms.
Mm-hmm.
If there was some kind of public option and through that we were able to reform it, I would say that, yes, we need structural change where physicians have the appropriate incentives. And so I think you would want to somehow I think the prepaid group experiment teaches us that physicians need to be tied to the bottom line in a way that encourages them to practice, well. Multi-specialty groups would be great, but they really need to be in charge of all that. They're the ones with the requisite expertise to decide what kind of care their patients need. We don't want a system that encourages them to ration care, and we don't want a system that encourages them to oversupply it either.
Yeah. Will that do it, Scott, or something else?
No, that takes care of it. I'm going to be really intrigued to see after the election what kind of plan emerges, because one way or another, it's going to be a hot issue. I do believe. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for the call. And such a divisive issue. I mean, prior to the ACA, it started off, I can remember doing talk shows where we had people from various political perspectives sitting around the table, everybody agreeing we've got to do something about the cost, and then explodes into this incredible bickering about this, and year after year of charges and countercharges when we're talking about the health of the American people. I don't really understand. Maybe you can help me understand this, Christy, why this is such a darn controversial issue.
Yes, it does seem like both sides have kind of hunkered down on their positions of what needs to be done. I guess I would point out, you know, everybody recognizes, at least we all recognize, something needs to change. And even now, I think everybody recognizes still something needs to change. Whether, I know some people want to repeal the ACA, but a lot of people want to keep it and continue to reform it. But I would make the argument that I think a lot of people, when they're offering their reforms, I would just ask them to keep in mind that this insurance company model, because, for example, if you look at some of the Republican reforms that have been offered in the past decade or two decade, they kind of overlook the fact that we already have this broken model, and the types of reforms that are offered are often kind of just more Band-Aid over the reform type things. For example, you know, selling insurance across state lines. Yes, that's very helpful, helps people get around some of, you know, this is pre-ACA, some of the state regulations that made insurance more and more expensive, some of the benefits that had to be covered. But I think a lot of people are losing sight of the fact that the system needs to be restructured more fundamentally. Which I do think the public option takes somewhat into account this idea that if the government offered some form of insurance, made it very generous, initially subsidized it to hold down costs, the thought between the behind the public option was that would weaken the insurance company model and insurance companies. You know, once, if there is more government power, then the thought is, can they restructure it fundamentally to line incentives up correctly? Because I think everybody's so afraid that there's going to be end up being a system where care is rationed. So mm-hmm. I think that's one of the big fears that drives mm-hmm. these very, very vicious debates on yeah. all sides.
Do you think people would have flocked to the public option had it been a part of the ACA?
You know, it's really hard to say. I think so. I mean, I think sometimes it's hard to say, because one problem with the way the ACA legislation was written is it was so ambiguous. That a lot depends on who's in the administration and who's in charge and who's in power. But my guess is, on a public option, they would have purposely given it all the bells and whistles as far as benefits go, and then held it down, because it's the federal government. They have the resources to be able to do that in a way that private companies do not, held down the price in order to get as many people on that as possible and start using that to change the system.
Chris in Wisconsin Dells, hi.
Hi, I'm going to try and talk as fast as I can because there's a lot here. I want her to talk a little bit about Big Pharma, and you'd have to go any farther than Tommy Thompson to do that, but I had a real interesting anecdote. I was working at a fine dining restaurant in downtown Milwaukee, and a drug company booked the entire restaurant for 100 doctors and their guests. All you can eat anything you want off the menu, and then in cleaning up, I had to watch a movie on bed sores, which I was not enjoying. But there's a lot of that going on, prying their way by money into the pockets
right.
of physicians. I have a list of things about personal responsibility. I think that it's real interesting that now that we're all in this together, that there's a different kind of a philosophical or psychological discourse going on, which is, what can we all do to lower the costs here? And I have a couple of suggestions. Number one, do your personal research. It's not like the internet isn't out there. And if you have a friend who's infirm, I'm helping an 80 year old friend who's got cataracts, who's never used a computer to do this, is do your own research. If you go into your doctor's office and you know what tests to order and you have a list of drugs and you know what you think is wrong with you, and they don't have to do that for you.
All right, I need to hold you there, Chris. We have tons of phone calls coming in. Personal responsibility in healthcare.
Oh, okay. Personal responsibility in healthcare. And I actually, one of the questions I would like to, she mentions Big Pharma and doctors
right.
and the concern that a lot of people have brought up before about, you know, these all expense paid trips, dinners, trying to convince doctors to prescribe their medications. I would, you know, point out that, you know, doctors are incentivized in certain ways under the current insurance company model. I'm going to keep going back to that because, the way doctors are incentivized to make money is by billing back the insurance company. It's not necessarily by being as creative as a lot of them would like to be with their patients, you know, tailoring things to how their patients need them. Sometimes they can, but a lot of times what they do, how they practice medicine, given certain diagnoses is dictated by the insurance company if they hope to make back their reimbursement from the insurance company. So I think that almost kind of gets to the question, too, of Big Pharma is how are physicians incentivized on costs? And because they're not in a situation where they're incentivized to woo the patient more, you know, pharmaceutical companies are able to have a lot more power then. And so I guess I would just say, if we're thinking about this on cost, I think what I ask your listeners to think about is we can certainly empower insurance companies or government officials to have more power over physicians to kind of beat them over the head with a big stick to contain costs. I, however, would not like to see that. I would like to explore ways that actually frees up. You know, I think a lot of times people think I'm beating up on the physicians because I'm showing what the AMA did and everything, but I do want to go back to the point of both for providing better care and also for getting costs under control. We need to figure out how to put more of this autonomy back with physicians, not with insurance companies or government officials who are, you know, coming up with longer and longer procedures to make sure that costs aren't, you know, services aren't squandered.
Mm-hmm.
And then so, of course, personal responsibility, your caller's point about that, that is very important. Physicians, because they're trying to get through as many services and procedures to bill back to the insurance company, you've probably heard the complaint about 15 minutes, 10 minutes with your physician,
right,
not enough time. They're under the constraints they are because of that. So, yes, taking some of this stuff into your own hand and being able to go in and make it as easy for your physician as possible certainly is wise.
Let's go next to Roger in Fitchburg. Hi, Roger.
Hi. I'm severely disabled and could be considered elderly. My cardiologist says that he wants socialized medicine, and our government pays 81% of health costs, so it doesn't make sense for us to have socialized medicine. It would make my life a lot more simple, not having to try to keep track of all the details of co-payments and so forth. I can't keep track of
it. I know. It gets wild, doesn't it, Roger? It's just, I know. It just gets wild. What do you think, Christy?
Well, I think, one thing I think is really interesting is if you look at people who are, you know, for socialized medicine, and then say you look at the very opposite extreme, people who are more, you know, for market competition and laissez-faire, I think what both sides would agree with is that what we have today is worse than either. I think people would say just go to one side or the other for Pete's sake. What we have now with this overlapping public-private mixture, layers of regulation from this place and that place, but nothing's comprehensively done. You know, everything is piecemeal, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Yeah, it's extremely complicated, and you have to be an expert in healthcare to understand what's going on, you know, to make sense of it. So I certainly understand why your physician would say that. Also, a lot of physicians, I think you hear the sentiment of, you know, working for an insurance company or working for the government, what's the difference? That's that increasing pressure that physicians are feeling, that they are being supervised in the way they practice by insurers, and what they're, you know, whether it's the kind of medicines they can prescribe. You know, a medicine's is dead in the water if insurance companies don't approve it in their fee schedule, and same with every single type of procedure and service. So, you know, that takes a lot of the creativity and the art out of medicine. Isn't just a science, it's an art as well. But in a lot of ways, we see that physicians have been straitjacketed from that. So I certainly understand that sentiment.
Yeah, thank you, Roger, for the call. This is worth hearing you talk about probably for hours now, but at least for part of the show. You write that today, U.S. medical care expenditures are the highest in the world, making up 18% of the nation's gross domestic product. Why?
Well, precisely because of this model that I mentioned, the insurance company model. The interesting thing about this model is when it was cobbled together back in 1938, the AMA came up with this model, and they thought they would be able to keep corporate power far, far away from them just by making these rules, fee for service, you know, that they would be paid for every service and procedure, They weren't allowed to be put on salary. They weren't allowed to be given capitation, which would be set payments per patient, you know, biannually or annually, and that they would have complete autonomy. They thought, okay, you know, we'll be able to keep the insurance company far away. But what you see is slowly over the course of decades, the insurance companies have had to get more involved in healthcare, And this is very expensive. Then if you look at a program like Medicare or the ACA, then you have another entire layer with the government trying to pass regulations to control costs that then go down to the insurance company that is creating its own regulations to control costs that then go to the physicians and the hospitals. And as you can imagine, you just get layer after layer of bureaucracy with, again, the proper people, the patients and physicians, not being incentivized to do things. And so instead, if we, you know, we keep on this path, it's just going to be that physicians and hospitals have less and less autonomy.
Christy Ford Chapin is our guest this hour, visiting scholar at Johns Hopkins University, assistant professor of history at the University of Maryland, author of Insuring America's Health, the Public Creation of a Corporate Healthcare System. Greg in Watertown, hi.
Hi, Kathleen and guests. Another great show. Thanks for that. It's got my blood boiling to some degree. And Ty Bollinger, in his new book, The Truth About Cancer, has a great beginning part on the history of modern medicine. He talks about how Carnegie and Rockefeller utilized $50 million back then, which is equivalent to $2 billion today, to form the American Medical Association and to get that established as kind of a regulating agency, the professional organization, if you will, for medicine. And what that did then was kind of push out of vogue, or once it was standardized to a point, then it sort of consolidated the control of the medical industry and all these other things, chiropractic, holistic medicine, alternative medicines, and cures were pushed out of vogue, essentially, and they were called quacks. And, you know, it seems to me that this, if that is true, this has sort of evolved into a medical, pharmaceutical, insurance, industrial complex, much like the military congressional industrial complex. You know, these complexes that should happen. And this medical industrial complex really doesn't do much for curing the disease. It tends to focus on treating symptoms, and it leads to, like, what's the first thing a doctor often does is to prescribe several different types of drugs that will cure this problem, as opposed to addressing the root causes of disease. And it seems to me that it's more about making money than it is about care.
Greg, thanks, Greg, for the call. Christy.
That's a great point you bring up. Now, I haven't read the book that the caller refers to, but as far as Rockefeller and Carnegie put a lot of money into medicine, into medical research, they were not behind the founding of the AMA. That was back in 1847. That was something physicians, they organized as groups all around the world, and that was certainly going to happen. And one of the main reasons that physicians wanted to found the AMA, they found it at the national level, but there were also constituent societies at the state level and then the city or county level. But one of the main reasons was for them to get this medical licensing, exactly what your caller was referring to as far as alternative medicine being stamped out. It depended state by state. Still, some homeopathic and osteopathic practitioners and such could obtain a license depending on what the state law was around it. But licensing was really important because basically that was gave the AMA the ability to be the primary regulators of the medical market. That's why they had so much power to not only say we are, you know, discrediting alternative forms of medicine, and probably even worse than just discrediting practitioners of those medicines was not allowing their own physicians to incorporate some of it either. But it allowed them really to regulate everything that went on in the market, because if doctors didn't conform not just scientifically and medically to what they said, but also economically and politically, they could lose their license. And then you see this as a problem, too, in, as far as African-American physicians go. You know, would they be able to actually get a license? It depended on the area, whether or not white physicians saw them as a potential competitive threat. So it just put a lot of power in the hands of these basically, you know, not officially AMA-run, but for all intents and purposes, AMA-run licensing boards at the state level.
Thanks so much for the call. More phone calls in a moment. We are talking about why insurance companies are in charge of our medical care in this country, what the history is, what the proposals for changes are, what might work better, why it's such an incredibly divisive issue in this country and has been for a long, long time. Our guest is Christy Ford Chapin. She is assistant professor in the history department at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. She's a visiting scholar at Johns Hopkins and author of the book Insuring America's Health, The Public Creation of the Corporate Health Insurance System. Our number, 800-486-8655. And we'll take more phone calls from you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, back to phone calls. David in Madison, hi.
Thank you. I'd be very interested to hear, however successful the model of physician groups from 1900 to 1930 were, what total percentage of the population might have been covered. But my question is about if the author would, and guest would comment on two connected dots. Introduction of employer-related health care plans, which, as I understand it, correct me if this is wrong, when wage and prices were frozen during World War II, as it got to be near the end of World War II, Waldo Ruther of the UAW went to Roosevelt and said, "You got to lift the wage and price controls." Roosevelt said, "We got to wait another year or so." And Ruther said, "Well, I'm going to give my people to negotiate in negotiations a health care type of plan." And then the courts, as it went through the courts, it became ruled that that was not income. And that's how we got, for one thing, the vast majority in the post-war boom, then employer-related health care, and used to be tied just to men, of course, at the time, but also then Cadillac plants, and also the resentment against public workers who negotiated very savvily for better benefits because it wasn't income. And then in COBRA, and I think it was 87, correct me if I'm wrong, people don't remember what COBRA stood for. I think it's the Consolidated Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act. When Reagan got in and slashed the income tax and raised military spending, the annual budget went from about $80 billion a year to about $300 or $400 billion. And then when the Democrats back in control of Congress in the mid to late 80s to help reduce that horrific budget deficit, they negotiated under that budget fix what became known as COBRA, which I think was that employers, if you lost in a more mobile society with workers changing jobs more frequently, is you could continue to pay individually for like 18 months after, but it continued the employer-based model. So if the author could comment on
sure.
the repercussions of those, that would be helpful.
Thanks, David.
Okay, sure. Well, first of all, to your first question about how popular prepaid physician groups were, they were extremely popular. Of course, looking back, we don't have comprehensive data. But as I mentioned before, there were at least 300 to 350 by the early 1930s. There were newspaper accounts about how popular they were. For example, there was a Ross Luce clinic in L.A. that within 4 or 5 years had, you know, over somewhere around 50,000 patients, 50 physicians, and ambulance service facility, its own library. So these were very, very popular among patients, consumers, and progressive reformers. Regarding employer-provided care, that's great that you're bringing up. I'm glad to get a chance to speak to
yes.
this idea. There is, that's one thing that a lot of people seem to connect the employer provision of health care to World War II, and that's partially correct. I'd like to push back on it a little bit. Political scientist Jacob Hacker and historian Jennifer Klein have shown really that the most important thing for creating employer provision was there was a loophole in the law that basically gave enormous tax breaks to businesses when they supplied fringe benefits to their workers. Now, you know, the kind of urban legend is that this really took off in World War II, but if you look at the numbers, I've gone back and I've looked at the data, they increased during World War II, the whole idea that there were wage freezes so employers could at least attract workers with these nice fringe benefits. But I think even without the war, and this is the same argument that Klein and Hanker make, it's really the tax break that's driving it, and you don't see any unusual spike during the early 1940s at all. You just see it on that climb that it's going through and that it would go through at any rate because of the tax loophole and because of the fact that it gave employers something to bargain over with. Now, unions are very important in the story of healthcare. I can't go into it too much here because of time, but at one point, you know, during the early 20th century, 20s, 1930s, even into the 40s and later, they're actually trying to get control of healthcare to run their own plants, and in some cases they do. But what the story ends up being is when they basically say, like Walter Reuther and such, realize this is going to be something that we negotiate over. And just as your caller said, indeed, it's true that they are responsible for helping push what begin as very stingy, very meager policies in the mid-1940s that cover maybe 60 to 80% of your hospital bills only, wouldn't cover any bills outside of the hospital, pushing that much more to what we're familiar with today. We expect now comprehensive coverage for almost all of our medical costs. And unions very much were responsible for setting the gold standard in the marketplace at the negotiating table, you know, starting with the big three automakers, you know, in steel industry and the different industries. And whatever they set it at, you could bet that the rest of the market would develop to meet it at that gold standard place within a few years. They were very savvy about healthcare. They knew a lot about it. They really understood the market.
Mm-hmm. Lauren sends this email. I was intrigued by Christy's description of a physician's group. I got a small taste of this at the hospital where my twin daughters were born. They have a rare form of Down syndrome. The NICU doctors at the hospital where they stayed the first few weeks of life met together along with the maternal fetal medicine doctors who handle high-risk pregnancies. My daughters are one now. They see multiple specialists at multiple clinics. I wish there was easier communication among them, and I wish that we got one bill or statement instead of bills and statements from a variety of clinics.
Oh, that's such a heartbreaking story.
Yes,
it really is. That really puts the face on, you know, sometimes I feel like I'm talking about dry issues of political economy, but that story gets to the heart of the matter about why this does matter so much. And you know, you just think what could have been. What if they did have the one-stop shopping where they could go and all the physicians from the general pediatrician to the specialist they were seeing are conferring together over their care instead of the parents having to be put in charge of managing. Make sure you tell this physician that, and that physician knows that they're on this medicine, will interact with that, and what about this kid? And like you said, the billing and the financing, it's really very sad.
Yeah. Patrick is next in Middleton. Hello, Patrick.
Hi. Yeah, hey, I'm a fairly recently retired pediatrician, and I mean, this topic just, you know, I'm a huge supporter for a single-payer health plan. Well, I know the reason why. It's not, I mean, to me, our country, you know, has a great medical system, except that there's so many people not insured or underinsured or going bankrupt, number one, and the expense of our system due to the insurance companies is incredible. It's higher than any other developed country in the world, yet our healthcare outcomes are not near those companies. And to me, it's a no-brainer, but the insurance companies, the pharmaceutical companies, and I'm not saying doctors aren't part of the equation, but they're the people that are making all of the money off of this system are the ones controlling the lobbyists and the politicians, and it'll unfortunately never change until we can get that out. The insurance companies need to be taken out of the equation with health care.
Right, right. Well, and that makes me think, just as you're speaking, like, you know, in a world, like, even if we went back, you know, putting this in historical terms to 1948 and the Truman Bill, you think if we did have some kind of single-payer system where physicians had been allowed to organize themselves, if you imagine a day, you know, where we did have multi-specialty groups today, but still you put enough of the autonomy with the physicians that they were able to contract with hospitals and have more power and freedom that way, we could still have that type of model with a single payer that wiped away a lot of the different levels of insurance company bureaucracy and then other types of bureaucracy as well.
And on that note, we say goodbye to you. Thank you so much, Christy, for the book and for writing all the articles about this. It's here we go again with another round of examination of healthcare. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Kathleen. I appreciate it.
Christy Ford Chapin, she is the author of Insuring America's Health, The Public Creation of a Corporate Health Insurance System, assistant professor in the History Department, University of Maryland, and also teaches at Johns Hopkins. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour. Thanks to Zeb Gozman for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Tomorrow during this hour, we're going to be talking about school discipline with the author of Ending Zero Tolerance, The Crisis of Absolute School Discipline. Thanks for your listening. Thanks for your many interesting calls.